Shrink Wrap Radio number 16, December 1st, 2005, Frank Small on Psychology in Australia. Hello to all of you out there in podcast land. This is David Van Nuys, a.k.a. Dr. Dave, coming to you once again from the beautiful wine country in Sonoma County, California. Shrink Wrap Radio is the podcast that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be an amateur, student, or professional. It's all the psychology you need to know and just enough to make you a little bit dangerous. It's all in your mind. ShrinkWrapRadio.com. Now, that bit that you just heard was created by today's guest, who is a 33-year-old psychology student who lives in Australia, not too far from Sydney. I met Frank Small online after he sent me an email professing avid enthusiasm for Shrink Wrap Radio. Later, he indicated that he'd like to be involved in this show as our correspondent from Down Under. Now, I'm not one to turn away such an enthusiastic volunteer, so I thought I'd better take this opportunity to introduce Frank to our listening audience. There's a good chance you'll be hearing more from him as time goes by. By way of introduction, here's my interview with Frank. Okay, so Frank Small is my guest, and you're located in Australia, about a 3.5-hour drive from Sydney, is that right?
It's in a town called Orange, just over the Blue Mountains, and it's quite a large central hub for the district. We've got about 36,000 people here, so it's not a small town.
Okay, and it's about 8 o'clock in the evening here. What time is it there?
It's almost 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh my goodness! And what's your weather like?
The weather, it's raining at the moment. It's been a constant drizzle all day,
It's truly a small world then, because it's raining here. So let's get into your interest in psychology, because, of course, that's what Shrink Wrap Radio is all about. When did you first decide that you wanted to become a psychologist?
The decision, I think we can pinpoint that down to a particular day. The date I've forgotten, but the three of us, my mother, my brother, and myself, we were sitting in the lounge room and discussing what we're going to do with our future, and all of us wanted to help people in some respect, and just departing from our former business as auctioneers, you know, it was a natural progression.
Well, I know we spoke previously about this natural progression, and you said that your family has been in auctioneering for three generations, and maybe you can tell us what it was you experienced in the auctioneering business that persuaded you that it was time to leave it and get into psychology.
There's a lot of stories, like being a chattel auctioneer. You know, you look around your house and everything that you can move out of the house, that's the type of stuff that we sold. And we dealt a lot with bankruptcies and deceased estates and divorces. And unfortunately, you see how people invest so much emotions in their material items and not in their family, especially with divorces and deceased estates. And you just see families tearing themselves apart about who wants what and who owns what and who's bequeathed what to whom. And it can be quite a sad moment. We've had one situation which stands out is two sisters. They were their mother just passed away, and they came in, and you know those little rocking chairs made out of clove pegs? They usually have a little plastic flower propped up on the seat. They'd only be about 10 inches in height. They're only small little ornaments. And this item, the two sisters were bickering and arguing so much so that during the auction, this little rocking chair that you could pick up at any bargain basement store for about $2 went for about $96 because these two ladies were arguing, and beforehand they were a real model family.
My goodness, yes, I certainly have. Fortunately, this hasn't happened in my own family, but I've known people where I've seen families kind of get torn apart after somebody has died, and people are fighting over the property and so on. So that was something that was troubling to you and your mother and your brother is about that business. Was there anything about psychology in particular that initially intrigued you as an alternative and that's drawn you towards psychology?
It was the umbrella of psychology. You don't miss out on helping anybody, really. We really loved the idea that psychology doesn't discriminate between race, cultural backgrounds, their religion. It doesn't discriminate. You're there to help the person in the here and now. And that's what really drove us to psychology.
And you say drove us. So are your mother and brother also studying psychology?
Yes, all three of us enrolled at the same time, and knock wood, we all got accepted at the same time.
Oh, that's really great. And where are you studying?
I'm studying in Bathurst, which is about 53 kilometres just east of us, at Charles Sturt University.
Okay, and how far along are you in your studies now?
I've got one subject left.
Just one subject? Is that
one subject?
Is that like a whole year or a semester or a matter?
It's a 13-week semester.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's advanced stats. That's all I've got left, and I'm done.
Ah, statistics, advanced statistics, the bane of many a student, of many a psychology student. And yes. So what are your plans once you get your degree? Is this a bachelor's degree that you're working on now?
Yeah, it's a bachelor's social science psychology.
So. From the conversations that we've had, I have the impression that your university system may be somewhat more rigorous than ours. It sounds to me like you've got a grasp of psychology that would at least be the equal of a master's degree student here.
Wow, I'm honored to hear you say that.
Well, they're doing a good job on you.
Well, they're currently thinking about extending the time of the degree at the moment. At the moment, for a social science psychology, it's a 3-year degree.
I see.
For a BA in psychology, it's a 4-year degree, and they're thinking about making it more an experiential course. So they're going to extend the time of it. So
okay.
It's just, at the moment, it's just talk. They're not. There's nothing really in the pipelines.
Right. Now, what are your plans once you get your degree?
We're allowed to take minor subjects of, and I chose theatre media. So, in the near future, I'll be studying up a little bit more about psychodrama, and the theatrical techniques in psychology.
Okay, and is that what theatre media means? Does that refer to some kind of integration of theatre and psychology?
No, two completely separate disciplines. I believe that us as humans, we're sort of categorizing everything in our minds. We categorize everything, you know, and with theatre, it's categorized to be in the theatre. It's purely one thing, and to mix two disciplines together, what I've found so far is quite a novel thing for the doctors and professors that are currently teaching me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So you're kind of looking forward to getting out of the program so that you can do your own integration.
Yes, yes, very much.
What is it about the theatric approach that speaks to you? There's something in there that's kind of pulling you, and what part of you is it that this is calling to?
It's the power. I've always, being an auctioneer, I use my voice a lot, and it's being an auctioneer is very much theatrics in itself.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Trying to coax the people to put their hand up and start bidding on items. And with theatre, I just realised that the power of theatre, the power of getting up and speaking to a large audience, can truly drive their emotions to where the actors want them. And using theatre as a tool in, say, group therapy, you can use the techniques of theatre to create a situation of reality, so the patients or the clients are able to make mistakes and in a safe environment and stand back from the theatre to see what they've just done and analyse it, so they can go out into the real world and not be frightened of making mistakes.
Okay, I see. And and in pursuing this line of thought, is there somebody whose work you've been most influenced by?
There's a person at Charles Sturt, Bill Blakey. He's really been a big influence. It's a shame that he hasn't written any books because he's a wealth of knowledge. And also, I've fallen in love with an author of Rainbow and Desire, The Rainbow of Desire, by Augustus Boal. And he talks a lot about the theatre of the oppressed, and it's very much an experimental theatre base where you give power back to the people. Instead of being a one-way conversation from the stage to the audience, you get the audience to come up on stage.
Okay. And so that's interesting. And you see yourself somehow being able to integrate that into a therapeutic approach?
Yes. I believe I've got the skills. It's just the confidence that I'm lacking at the moment. So I'll be working on that.
Yes, yes. We all have to start somewhere. And, you know, we start from zero and then build up from there. What's the mental health licensing set up there in Australia? You know, what kind of hoops are you going to have to jump through in order to be able to work with people to do this?
To be recognised as a counsellor or a psychotherapist, there are no real legislative hoops to jump through. I could hang up a shield now and call myself a counsellor or a psychotherapist. Although, if you want credibility, you have to join an association, such as the Australian New Zealand Counselling and Psychotherapies Association. To be able to call yourself a psychologist, that is governed by legislation, where you have to obtain a master's or above.
Okay, so do you see yourself joining an association like that?
Yes, I'm looking into joining the. I'm not quite sure of the name of it. I'm going to a seminar on Friday, of the Psychodrama Association in Sydney. So
that would be excellent if they have an association and you could join it, and then you would get additional training and supervision by virtue of being a member of the association. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, they hold a year-long course in psychodrama, which is purely experiential. It's made up of four modules, and they hold your hand as you go through the experience of developing yourself as a proficient psychodrama therapist.
Excellent. I really think that the experiential work is so important for people who want to work with other people. You can only get so far reading books, and really it's the hands-on experience, and also the experience in working on your own issues.
Truly, that's correct, yeah. Well, that's a big debate at the moment. I've noticed that at uni, that there's one school of thought that says, yes, psychology must be an experiential based learning, where there's another school of thought that maintains, no, it's a discipline, and experience is not necessary in a discipline. So that's rather sad to hear.
Yeah. Now, I'm wondering, do you see a few years down the road, do you see yourself going on to do any advanced academic study in psychology, or do you think this will be the end of the road for you academically?
I don't know. I've really enjoyed my academic life. Writing the assignments and doing the research, I've really enjoyed it. So if I do go on to onto further studies, it'll be on a part-time basis. So I do see myself continuing in the field, because I don't know, human nature is just so fascinating.
Right. From your studies in psychology, do you have a sense of what the dominant theoretical outlook is there in Australia? I'm particularly interested in what the dominant theoretical approach to clinical work is there.
It's very much a fight between the qualitative and the quantitative components. As the people that are true behavioralists maintain that, you know, the quantitative methods and the rigorous statistical procedures must be carried out, whereas there's another group of teachers that maintain no, qualitative is the way to go. It's it gives democracy back to psychology. Instead of questionnaires and surveys to give out to people, with the qualitative psychology, you give the people a voice to, so you can hear what they have to say instead of assuming what's in their mind.
Dare I ask which camp you are in?
Qualitative.
I thought I detected that. We certainly have that same schism here in the U.S. We probably exported it all around the world, is my guess. Do you have any particular heroes in the field of psychology that inspire you?
No one hero. I'd like to maintain a sort of an eclectic sort of a thought about the history of psychology. From your previous interviews that I've listened to on the internet, it's the most I've ever learnt about Jung. So Jung's quite interesting.
Oh, good. Well, yes. I hope we can bring you more. I know we will bring more guests on who will be speaking about different aspects of Jungian psychology, since that's one of my biases. What books have influenced you most?
Well, besides the one I previously mentioned, the Rainbow of Desire by Augustus Boal, which is not really a psychology book, it's more a theatre book, I'd have to say the Emotional Intelligence by Goldman.
Daniel Goldman.
Mm-hmm. That's him, yes, Daniel Goldman.
Right.
And why IQ is so inadequate for measuring people.
Yeah, his book has had a tremendous impact and is an often cited book. I'll put links to both of those books on the show notes in case people want to follow up on those. I'm always interested in the practical value of psychology, and I'm wondering if you have found any theories or tools or techniques in your study of psychology that have helped you in your own personal life.
Techniques of memory, that has helped a lot, being able to chunk information into blocks. But really it's just that ability to be more reflexive, to look within myself and to understand why, say for instance, I get an emotional reaction to something that's just a visual stimuli, and it's quite fascinating to realize that my cultural upbringing, my family history, has had so much of an impact on how I see reality and how I see other people, and it's all these little biases that we carry around in ourselves that has been socialized in us since birth that we realize are not correct. They're false beliefs. And just it's been a big thing changing myself.
Yeah, that's a major learning when we begin to be able to stand outside of ourselves and realize something about the extent to which we are shaped by family and by culture, and realizing that there are other people in other parts of the world who have a different set of experiences and don't necessarily experience things the way that we do.
And again, with I've got a couple of friends that have suffered a mental trauma through either a severe change of lifestyle, and just being able to listen to their story and understand myself what they're going through, like just changing from an important job environment to being retired or retrenched is a massive blow on one's ego. And I've got two friends that have been retired, and they had to go and seek either mental counselling, or they had to go into the mental hospital. So,
what's the attitude, by the way, towards that in Australia? What's the attitude towards people seeking out counselling or psychotherapy?
It's slowly changing, but the stigma behind counselling and psychotherapies in the city, like Sydney, Melbourne, it's far more accepted. But in the bush, out here in the sticks, it's still very much of an old school. You know, if you can't see a problem, the problem just does not exist. And even so, you know, if a person has a bad injury, you know, it's a case of, you know, oh, she'll be right, we'll just carry on with the job at hand. And for instance, I know of one poor girl just further out west from us that I suspect, and others do as well, that she's got I've forgotten the problem, the eating problem, where the opposite to bulimia is anorexia.
Yes.
And the parents just do not see that she's not eating, and every time she does eat, she whinges and complains and goes to the toilet and throws up, and they just deny that there's a problem there completely. Mm-hmm. So she's going downhill quite drastically, and even trying to tell somebody that there's a problem that just doesn't want to believe it, you just can't help. It's like telling a drunk that they're drunk. It's very hard.
Right. As you will experience as you move more and more into becoming a counselor and therapist, you'll discover that it's, you know, that change is slow, and usually there aren't any magic bullets. I know you shared with me. Do you mind my sharing your age here?
No, not at all.
On the air, just because people might be curious. And you're 35 now. You went back to school after.
No,
is that 33, right?
33, sorry.
Oh, 33. You're 33, and so you went back to school actually after having a kind of an adult career. So you've been going through a transition yourself. How has that transition been, by the way? What's that been like for you to be in that sort of transition?
Wow. We were doing nothing once we closed the auction down, waiting to be accepted at university. We had about 6 months of doing nothing. We were basically unemployed, just waiting to get into uni, and I didn't want to take a job in case I'd start muddling in my life. And it was very, very much like retiring. The phone used to ring all the time, and the phone just stopped ringing. And then the first year of university, wow, you know, it was a real culture shock.
In what way?
Well, the words that you use don't seem adequate enough.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go along to lectures, and there are these doctors and professors standing up in front of this crowd of kids. Well, when they come out of school, they're about 19, 20 years old, 18, 19. And they'd be using this multi-syllable lingo that was just flying over the top of my head. And reading a lot of the papers that we'd have to take home, I'd be there with the paper in front of me, a dictionary and a psychology dictionary, and it was painstaking work, just trying to catch up on this new language that I threw myself into.
Yeah, boy, that is a big transition. And you must have been one of the older students then. What was that like for you?
Yeah, an older student and a minority male. You somehow don't feel accepted by the other students. I don't know whether they're frightened of coming up to you, or it's just your own ideas about the uni culture, but you really feel isolated as a mature age student. And to combat that situation, the university has got a mature age club, students club going.
So oh, good. Yeah, we have something like that at my university. So sort of a, I think they call it a re-entry program. Mm. And I know that's been important. And at the same time, having been a university professor, I can tell you that it's the returning students, the re-entry students, that you really prize, because in general, they're mature. They've learned things in the world. They know more than they think they do coming in. They often come in feeling insecure, but actually turn out to be the best students. I've often said education is wasted on the young.
Well, that's one of the biggest critiques from some of the lecturers there, is that younger students that have come straight out of school into another schooling system don't have that life experience. And I've noticed myself, I've doing organizational psychology and psychology of management, that I can draw on the knowledge that I gained in business, and you read pages and you think, my goodness, you know, I know this. Why does it take somebody with a degree to write this? I know this. And
good for you. Perhaps you'll be writing your own books down the line. As a matter of fact, you know, you're 33 now. When you look back at your life and your career 25 years from now, what would you like to have accomplished?
That's a difficult question.
I know, I'm glad nobody ever asked me that question.
What I'd really like to accomplish is being able to help as many people as I can. It's I think that to feed my ego, which is something, well, that's what we all want, is just a pat on the back to saying, you know, Frank, you're doing a good job there, is to be able to have the results behind you to say, you know, hey, this technique of using theatrical techniques in drama is worthwhile pursuing and shouldn't be laughed at.
Yeah, good for you. And what qualities or skills do you think you'll need to develop in yourself so that this scenario can come true?
Building on the confidence at this stage, I've run one workshop, and I'm coming up, I think in about 2 weeks' time, giving a talk at the Masonic Club here in Orange, and just being able to, I don't know, experience the job now, so I can move ahead, I suppose. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. And I'm remembering from a previous conversation, you know, you just mentioned giving a talk to the Masonic Club, and you were telling me some things about Masonry that I was unaware of. Maybe you could just, you know, as we begin to close off here, just give us a kind of a brief overview of your take on Masonry.
Well, Masonry... I am a Mason, a third degree Mason myself, and well, the thing about Masonry is that it's got this stigma about being a secret society and all that. And there's so many books available now that you can learn about Masonry, and the volume of the Sacred Law is the Bible that we use. You think about what do you have in your possession right now to identify yourself as a psychologist to people that you don't know, and that's the certificates you have of the degrees that you possess, isn't it?
Yes.
And you know, you think back 1,000, 2,000 years when stonemasons could not read or write. They knew their trade about how to cut masonry slabs of granite or whatever. But how do you go to a new town and prove yourself to be a Mason? So that is the secret component about it. Their certificate of their proficiency as a Mason is held up in these secret handshakes and these secret words. And that was their certificate to be a qualified Mason. So it was all revolving around how do you prove yourself. We nowadays, the majority of us can read and write, and we can read what a certificate says. In those days, they didn't have that knowledge. A lot of people were illiterate. So, and masonry itself is it's a passing on of knowledge through theatrical techniques.
Oh, so there actually is theater involved in masonry?
Well, it's more to do with a ritual theater, but well, like the Aboriginals here in Australia, they pass on their knowledge mm-hmm. through song and dance and storytelling. I presume it would be the same with the American Indians, mm-hmm. that a lot of the wealth of knowledge that was passed down through the ancestors is through song, dance, and storytelling. And it's the same in masonry. We don't have a lot of dance, but through song, through storytelling, and through placing people in certain roles, information can be transmitted from one generation to the next. And by transforming these tools of masonry, like the hammer and the chisel and the plumb rule and all these different items, you turn them into being a symbolic representation of morality. And I could talk for quite a while on masonry, but we're running short of time.
Okay, well, maybe some future time we'll have a chance to do that. Actually, you have volunteered to sort of help the cause of Shrink Wrap Radio. So you and I will be having lots of contact with one another as you become our correspondent from down under, and listeners will be hearing
I hope so, and I truly appreciate your acceptance of me.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, you've stepped up to the plate with energy and enthusiasm, and so I look forward to our association, and we'll see what comes of it. So I want to thank you for this interview. And we'll be talking to each other.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay. It's all in your mind. ShrinkWrapRadio.com.
Psychology.
Okay, Frank. Thanks for taking us out with that promo you created. One of the Jungian topics we've touched upon in passing is synchronicity, which refers to coincidences that are too coincidental to seem merely coincidental. Now, to understand the story, you have to first know that if you set Skype to the Skype Me setting, you can receive phone calls from absolute strangers anywhere in the world who also happen to be on Skype. You may recall that last week's show was about Islam in Morocco. While I was putting that show together, I received my first such unexpected Skype call from a stranger in Morocco. We didn't get to chat because my computer settings were off, but I did get to instant message him, asking him, "Where are you?" And his reply was, "I am in Morocco." And, of course, I hadn't yet posted the show about Islam in Morocco to the Internet. Now, if that's not synchronicity, I don't know what is. Well, that's it for today. As usual, we'd love to hear from you. You can see what it did for Frank in Australia. Send your emails or MP3 audio comments to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You'll find our show notes at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. On Skype and Gizmo Project, our name is ShrinkPod. If you are enjoying our podcast, please rate us on the Yahoo directory at podcast.yahoo.com and on the Odeo directory at www.odeo.com. That's spelled O-D-E-O. Be sure to stay tuned after our ending theme music for your bonus selection of PodSafe music. In the meantime, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
fertilize the fallow field, it furnishes the greatest yield. So we are on the road to Terra Nova. But when the day is nigh at hand, and you is old and land is land, where will we find the end in Terra Nova? And will the tone of history to preserve more?